I'm Gail Harris. Robin Young is off today.
I'm Frank Stacio.
It's Here and Now.
British authorities have charged 8 men with plotting to commit murder and terrorist acts in a case linked to the U.S. terror alert earlier this month. The suspects appeared in court today for the first time since they were arrested 2 weeks ago. Joining us on the line from London is WBUR's Michael Goldfarb. Welcome, Michael.
Hello, Frank.
What are the charges? What are the specifics in this case?
Well, the specifics as they were laid out in court today were, one, first charge, conspiracy to murder. Two, second charge, conspiracy to commit public nuisance by use of radioactive materials, toxic gases, chemicals, and or explosives. And then there were two other charges relating to possession of documents likely to be used in terrorist acts. And these included what were described as reconnaissance plans of New York Stock Exchange, International Monetary Fund headquarters in D.C., and the Prudential Building in Newark. And one of the men was also charged because he had a copy of the terrorist's handbook. But the interesting thing about the charges is that they're very broad. They relate to activities going back to the 1st of January 2000 up to the moment that the men were arrested earlier this month. And much of the evidence seems to have come from the raid in Pakistan in July, which netted the man who's alleged to have organized the attacks in Kenya in 1998.
I saw something about, and you mentioned, poison gas, radioactive material. None of that material was found, was it?
No. In fact, none of the material mentioned in that second charge of conspiracy to commit public nuisance was found on the men. Most of this evidence came from the computers seized in Pakistan back in July. And, in fact, the main suspect in this group, a man named Diren Barot, who goes by a variety of aliases, including Isa al-Hindi and Musa al-Britani, relate to a trip that he took to the United States, at least the records in the computers are claimed to show this, back in early 2001. It seems as if this may have been a cell that was active at approximately the same time as the 9/11 cell was active, but it's not clear what activities they've been up to in the last couple of years.
Yeah, so it's not particularly clear that they were up to anything right now. They were packed and ready to go for a particular mission.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that what is likely to happen in the court case as it unfolds, and this is going to take months, as the men are held in Belmarsh Prison, is that they will be working backwards through the evidence found on these computers in Pakistan to try and unravel the nature of the cell and exactly what it was up to.
All right. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you, Frank.
WBUR's Michael Goldfarb speaking to us from London.
This morning, John Kerry told veterans that he would never hesitate to take strong action when defending his country.
I will never give any nation or any international institution a veto over our national security, and I will build a stronger military. But in these dangerous times, there is a right way and a wrong way to be strong. Strength is more than tough words.
Kerry spoke at the Veterans of Foreign Wars Convention in Cincinnati 2 days after President Bush spoke to that group. On Monday, we spoke with a former Clinton-era defense official about the president's speech. So joining us today on the line from Washington is Danielle Plutka, Vice President of Policy and Defense at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute. And Danielle, what did you think overall about the defense policy laid out in Kerry's speech? He mentioned, not surprisingly, providing more support for soldiers and veterans both in America and on the battlefield.
I didn't think that he laid out anything new. There were lots of the buzzwords that we're used to hearing, strength, service to veterans, but I didn't hear any new ideas. I didn't hear anything that rocked my world.
What about his point that our allies in Germany and NATO and South Korea in particular will not be happy about the troop redeployment that was laid out in the Bush plan?
I have to say, I'm really shocked that Kerry's going down that road. I think that while there may be reasons to criticize the redeployment, the major complaints have been from German unions, which are worried about loss of employment in towns where there are American bases. The idea that somehow a German union is of more importance than bringing American families home and rethinking the legacy deployments of the Cold War, I think is a little bit foolish.
Also on Monday, President Bush used his speech to criticize Kerry for saying that he wanted to reduce the number of troops that were in Iraq and that he would do that in his first 6 months in office. Bush's comment was, well, then all our enemies have to do is wait for 6 months and one day. What's your notion about the wisdom or lack thereof of withdrawing troops from Iraq?
I have never been a fan of dates and exit strategies that are based on a timeline rather than on the mission. We should leave Iraq when the mission is accomplished. We should stay in Iraq for as long as it takes to accomplish that mission, not just because the mission is so important, but because our own soldiers need to know where they're going to be, for how long they're going to be there, and they need to know that they have started a job, they're dedicated to that job, and we're going to let them finish that job.
Well, keep them there even though more and more Americans seem to be disapproving of the war?
America is a democracy, and we're going to vote in a few months on this question. But at the end of the day, you do not deploy our military based on polls, and you do not withdraw our military based on polls. I hope that any president, John Kerry included, if he's elected, will base his decision-making about where our troops need to be on our national interests, not on what Gallup has to tell him on a particular day.
On another topic, John Kerry has been condemning an ad by the liberal group MoveOn.org. It criticizes President Bush's military service in the Vietnam era. And, of course, as you know, President Bush has refused to condemn a similar ad that was directed at Kerry. Do you think those kinds of ads are appropriate, and should both candidates condemn them?
I don't like these ads. I don't like any of them. I didn't like the MoveOn ad that compared Bush to Hitler. I thought it was disgusting. If these ads are going to be out there, we've got to recognize that both sides are going to scrape lower and lower and lower because they can, because they're surrogates. And we either have to make a decision that the ads are okay and recognize that we're going to see a lot of mudslung, or we've got to make a decision that the ads are not okay and we've got to get rid of them. I would certainly favor getting rid of all of them. I don't think they add to the debate in any way. But I don't think this is a game in which one person says, I didn't like that ad. Well, I didn't like that ad. At the end of the day, if people are allowed to speak out in this fashion, whether they are people who want to compare Bush to Hitler or others who want to question John Kerry's service record, I think we've got to recognize that either the window's there or the window's not there.
Danielle, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Danielle Pletka is Vice President of Policy and Defense at the American Enterprise Institute. She spoke to us from Washington.
A top contributor to the campaign of embattled New Jersey Governor James McGreevy is expected to plead guilty today to three criminal counts. The plea by Charles Kushner follows a lengthy government investigation into his finances. Meanwhile, McGreevy is holding firm to his November deadline for leaving office. He announced last week he was stepping down after admitting to having an extramarital homosexual affair with a former aide. Joining us on the line from Trenton, New Jersey is Herb Jackson, State House columnist for the Record of Bergen County. Welcome, Herb.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Tell us a little bit about these charges. Three charges, right?
Yes, there are three charges. One is defrauding the Internal Revenue Service. Another is lying to an investigation by the Federal Election Commission looking into his campaign contributions. And the juiciest one is tampering with witnesses into that investigation, including his brother-in-law, by hiring a prostitute to sleep with his brother-in-law and then sending the tape to his sister.
Yeah, that's the one that's really caught everybody's attention.
And he was charged with that about 3 or 4 weeks ago. Yeah. That was one of the first of several landmines we were seeing in the horizon for Governor McGreevy. I'll tell you, the one that we didn't expect was the one that actually blew him out of the water last week, though. So
Kushner also had a connection to the man at the center of that McGreevy scandal, Gallant Cipel. Tell us
right.
about that.
Well, Kushner was a major financial backer of Governor McGreevy in his two campaigns for governor and in a committee that the governor maintained in between that, when he lost the first time for governor and when he ran again. And that was when Golan Cipel came over and from Israel, and Kushner was his sponsor with the Immigration Service and gave him a job. But he was also handling some campaign duties with McGreevy as outreach for the Jewish community in New Jersey.
Let's talk about the governor for a minute. He does seem determined to hold on. Of course, he announced he'd step down after the election, November 15th. Now there's some Democrats. Democrats seem to be split over whether he ought to do it sooner. Tell us about that division in the party.
And apparently polls are split, too. There's about two polls that have come out since Thursday, and both of them have shown about 40% think he should leave right away, 40% think he should stay. The significance of the next 3 weeks are if he's still in office after September 3rd, then Senator Richard Cody from Essex County, who is the state Senate president, will serve as acting governor until the next governor elected in 2005 is sworn in. There are a lot of it started with the Republicans who were saying we need a special election right away. But then there were a lot of people who are not big fans of Senator Cody, who would like to see him not be in power for those 14 months. And they're trying to convince John Corzine to come out, the U.S. senator, to come out and call for McGreevy to step down earlier so that Corzine could run in a special election this November.
John Corzine is, as you say, the leading candidate at this moment, or the name that pops up most often as the one who might run for that in a special election, run for the governor's office. Any indication he will do that? Any indication that he's going to ask McGreevy to step down early?
He said that he wouldn't mind running for governor, but he doesn't want to push McGreevy out. He is not trying to push McGreevy out right now, according to his public statements. He's talking to people who would like him to run, and I believe what's happened is he said, if there is a special election, I guess I would run. And that's been taken by some people to say he wants McGreevy to go, so there'll be a special election. Some people believe that if we have an election in November, and the Democrats win, then all of this scandal stuff is now sealed off. We can say, oh, the voters had a chance to have expressed their views on that, and they didn't take it out on the Democrats, so we can go into 05 and not worry about it. I believe the Republicans believe the opposite, which is if we have a special election in November, maybe voter anger at the Democrats over this whole tarnishing of New Jersey's image will work to the benefit of President Bush.
Tarnishing of New Jersey's image.
All right, come on. Don't go down there.
Herb, thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you, Herb.
You're welcome, Frank.
Herb Jackson, the State House columnist for the Record of Bergen County.
Just ahead, Catholic churches begin closing their doors despite resistance from parishioners.
And later in the show is bureaucracy in the Department of Energy allowing unsafe conditions at nuclear facilities.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Frank Stachow.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
The Archdiocese of Boston is one of many grappling with financial problems and diminished attendance these days, two changes leading to what will be hundreds of church closings across the country. In Boston alone, 73 churches are scheduled to shut their doors over the passionate objections of many church members. WBUR's Monica Brady Myroff recently went to a parish council meeting at St. Bernard's in Newton, Massachusetts, to take a closer look.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, let us pray.
A heavy sadness hangs over this moment of silence as Father Paul Kilroy begins the parish council meeting.
Loving and gracious God, as we continue on this journey, we know that you are leading us. We are not sure oftentimes about the direction and the destination.
The parish council of St. Bernard in Newton is made up of 12 lay Catholics who meet regularly to help Father Kilroy maintain the church and run parish activities. But tonight's meeting isn't about fixing anything in the church. It's about trying to save the parish, or, failing that, how to say goodbye to it. As part of an overall restructuring, the archdiocese decided St. Bernard must close. The death notice, as these parishioners call it, makes Leora Malone feel powerless.
I'm angry. I'm hurt.
Betrayed,
absolutely. You know, and whoever is sitting there making judgments has power over all of us, and we have absolutely no recourse. I mean, there's nothing we can do.
Parish council members have been informally appealing the decision ever since they learned their fate in May, arguing they're a vibrant and growing parish. Parishioners put up lawn signs and wrote letters. Three parish members met with Archbishop Sean O'Malley's assistant, Bishop Richard Lennon. Lennon said he would meet with the archbishop and plead their case. But John Berkeley, a lawyer and vice president of the council, tells the meeting he's received word that O'Malley won't change his mind.
I don't know if we got the short shrift. I don't know if the meeting took place. I don't know if it was a long meeting or a short meeting, or those crazies out in Newton are up to their same antics and let me send them a letter. But the point is, at this point, our informal attempts at persuading them that they've made a mistake, and that really was the thrust of the meeting, that they made a mistake and can't you own up to it? At this point, our informal attempts at that have been all denied.
Now they must decide whether or not to make a formal appeal to the archdiocese. They assume this will fail, and they would then appeal to the Pope. The anger and disappointment in this room is palpable. Don Schneider gets emotional when he argues that even though an appeal seems like a futile gesture, he wants to push ahead with it.
There were thousands and thousands of people who came before us who sacrificed to build this beautiful place of worship. I think we owe it to them, you know. To appeal.
Schneider, who's a lawyer specializing in bank regulation, has educated himself about canon law and drawn up the appeal. But he warns the council not to get too optimistic.
There are only two real rules we have to know. First rule is the bishop is always right. The second rule, if the bishop is wrong, see rule number one.
While it's meant to be a joke, no one laughs. But there is division among the group. Some want to keep fighting the decision for as long as they can. Others have sadly resigned to the reality that their beloved parish will close in about 2 months. The Archdiocese of Boston says St. Bernard is closing because Newton doesn't need 7 Catholic churches. And it says St. Bernard was picked for reasons of geography. The Archdiocese wants open parishes to be in central areas. But the nearly 3,000 St. Bernard parishioners think there are more nefarious reasons explaining why the archdiocese is closing a parish with high mass attendance and the third highest rate of baptisms, weddings, and funerals in Newton. Parish council members speculate the archdiocese targeted St. Bernard because the church, offices, and grounds are estimated to be worth $11 million. Some council members believe it's retribution for Father Kilroy's outspoken views criticizing the church hierarchy for its handling of the clergy sexual abuse scandal. He was one of a handful of priests who signed a letter calling for Cardinal Bernard Law's resignation. Whatever the reason, parish council member John Mahoney says it's time for him and everyone else to move on.
I think the critical question for everybody really is, what are you going to do? And that's, you know, what church are you going to go to? Are you going to stay in this church? And just wrestling with you know, where your faith is.
Mahoney, who's the director of undergraduate admissions at Boston College, says he's distraught.
I'm also adrift. I really am adrift. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know what my kids are going to do. I've got one daughter who's at the age where I feel as though, given how hard I've worked and fought and spoken out on this particular issue, it would be hypocritical of me now to tell her, well, we're going to go to this church and you're going to go to this religious education program. She's not going to take it.
St. Bernard has already canceled its religious education programs in preparation for the closing. The council agrees they need a professional to help the parish work through their emotions. They decide to hire a counselor to run a listening session open to all parish members. George Brandy says the moderator better be prepared for some raw anger.
So from my personal perspective, I can go to this thing with all the negativity I get built up in. It's not going to be easy to diffuse.
Robert Ryan, who works in organizational development, is worried about those like him who are being driven away from the Catholic Church.
I think there's a large population of people out there who are dropping out.
And I'm concerned that we in our parish and our archdiocese have greatly overlooked the impact on, maybe one of the reasons everyone could fit in St. Philip's or Corpus Christi is there won't be anyone going.
Father Kilroy suggests mailing notices of the meeting to all parishioners to reach those who aren't coming to Mass anymore. Near the end of the meeting, the discussion moves back to how to mark the closing of a parish. Some want a dinner dance, others a lunch, others a wake. They agree to hold one final Mass on closing day, October 24th, followed by a lunch.
10, 11, 12 o'clock to a liturgy, then have a luncheon celebration at Marriott or 4:40, whatever's available.
Yeah, or on the lawn, maybe out back. We got some big tents. Just ideas, whatever.
No, it's fine. Yeah, that's fine. No, I'm just doing it.
Everyone around the table agrees paying for a party won't be difficult. For once, the parish has money in the bank that isn't slated for building improvements, because in 2 months, the church won't be theirs anymore. And many on the parish council say they don't want to leave a penny for the archdiocese when it assumes the assets of St. Bernard's.
WBUR's Monica Brady-Meyerhoff. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Frank Stachow.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
It's called Technical Area 18, and it's said to be the most vulnerable nuclear storage facility in the Los Alamos National Laboratory Complex. TA-18 houses several tons of weapons-grade uranium and plutonium. The Department of Energy has ordered all fissile material removed from TA-18, but according to a government watchdog group, when the University of California, which runs Los Alamos, recently proposed starting that removal now, ahead of schedule, DOE administrator said no. To explain how that could be, we are joined first by Peter Stockton. He is a senior investigator for POGO, the Project on Government Oversight, based in Washington, D.C. Peter, welcome.
Hello.
Tell us first about TA-18. I know you've had some issues with this site for a number of years. What's the evidence that security has been lax there?
The major problem with protecting TA-18 is that it's in a canyon, and the bad guys have the high ground. And in virtually every credible attack force-on-force, mock attack on the facility, they lose about 80% of their guard force. They've had some interesting mock attacks there. One is called, one of our favorites is a garden cart, where normally when the bad guys come in, they steal enough material, either highly enriched uranium or plutonium, for several bombs, and they can put it in their rucksacks and leave. This time, Los Alamos said, no, you need to steal 200 pounds. And so they went to Home Depot, bought a garden cart, attacked in the middle of the night, got the 200 pounds out, and about 5 minutes later, the guard force started shooting at each other.
Mm.
The other, which people don't quite appreciate, is in October of 2000, there was another force-on-force mock attack, and the bad guys got into one of the kivas and got a hold of hundreds of pounds of highly enriched uranium and created what's called an improvised nuclear device. It's not a dirty bomb. It's an actual nuclear explosion, and it's 1 to 2 kilotons, and it would have taken out a chunk of northern New Mexico.
And what's happened since 9/11? Have things gotten a little tighter there?
Not a whole lot better. I mean, first of all, it's virtually an impossible site to protect. They spend $35 to $40 million a year on securing the site, and they do about $2 million worth of business. and which makes absolutely no economic sense. Secretary Richardson, when I was working for him back in 2000, ordered that the site be de-inventoried by 2004. I didn't agree with that at all because I felt you could get it out of there in 9 months.
And so what was the plan to try to get some of this dangerous material out of there?
It was just to move the material that you actually needed to the device assembly facility at the Nevada test site. It's probably the most secure facility in the world. It's out in the middle of a desert, and it's bermed. There's only one side that you see, and the special forces have run against us any number of times and gotten absolutely nowhere.
So at some point, the director of the facility decided to accelerate the removal, and DOE said no?
That's right. We have this on very good sources that about 2.5 weeks ago, a senior official of the laboratory went to the Department of Energy and said, we want to move this on a priority basis and get this material out of there. And they were actually turned down, which is a totally contrary to our experiences before, where it was Los Alamos that was dragging their feet.
Well, it seems particularly bizarre in light of the fact that, you know, the government is worried about terror strikes. The whole country's on alert. Why on earth would you allow that material to sit out there in the desert where, presumably, it's pretty vulnerable to somebody coming along and getting it?
This has really been bizarre over the years, I've got to tell you. When I was in the department, I worked for 2 years for the secretary, and I was on the Hill and overseeing the department. You often heard, look, we've had these facilities for 60 years, and nobody's attacked them yet. And you say, hey, you know, for a number of years, we had the World Trade Center, too. Mm-hmm. And it really makes absolutely no sense.
Now, your group wrote to the Secretary of Energy about this on Friday. What kind of response do you think you'll get?
They are scrambling at the moment, trying to figure out what the hell happened, actually. And, you know, hopefully they get this thing back on course.
Well, is there any way to account for this? I mean, we get it. There's red tape. There's bureaucratic infighting. Things take longer than you think they're going to. But it's just really hard to explain this one, isn't it?
It is. I mean, you hear these bizarre things, and I've heard it a thousand times. The scientists wouldn't like it. What scientists? We'll interview those scientists. Well, just scientists in general. And then you interview the scientists, and the scientists are not upset at all about moving this material to the Nevada test site.
Peter, thank you so much.
Okay, good luck.
Peter Stockton is the senior investigator at the watchdog group POGO, the Project on Government Oversight. We turn now to Brian Wilkes, a spokesman for the NNSA, the National Nuclear Security Administration. That's the agency responsible for managing the nation's nuclear weapons stockpile. And Brian, you just heard, as we did, what POGO's concerns are. What's your response?
Well, my response is that we have a goal of beginning to move the material out of TA-18 to the device assembly facility in Nevada, at least 50% of it, beginning at some point in September. We are on track and remain committed to moving this material. And in fact, Dr. Everett Beckner, who heads up the weapons programs for the National Nuclear Security Administration, recently had a telephone conversation with the lab director, Pete Nanos, to remind him of the importance of this mission and moving this material out. We actually are committed to removing all of the material out of TA-18, and it's just flat wrong that there was any proposal made or denied in this case.
So you're saying, in terms of POGO's basic assertion, that people at the lab went to NNSA and said, here's how you can get this stuff moved out of here even more quickly, and were told it wasn't a priority. You're saying it didn't happen?
Did not happen. We've checked with a number of folks, including the University of California, which POGO is alleging made this proposal, and the University of California says they have no idea what POGO is talking about. So it just didn't happen. You know, they've been wrong in the past, including the recent past, and this is probably one of those times where they don't have such a good batting average.
So whatever security lapses there may have been in the past, you're confident that TA-18 is now secured to your satisfaction, to the department's satisfaction?
Absolutely. And you know, we're talking about the same place, but two different issues. The first issue is whether the material there is secure right now, and the answer to that is absolutely, especially with all the recent upgrades and the upgrades over the past several years since the terrorist attacks of 9/11. And the second issue is whether or not we are going to move the material out of TA-18. And it's something that we're on track and are absolutely committed to.
Brian, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Brian Wilkes is a spokesman for the NNSA, the agency responsible for managing the nation's nuclear weapons stockpile. To read more from POGO and from the NNSA, go to our website, here-now.org.
Still to come, the shows must go on. Sluggish ticket sales haven't damped the Canadian spirit at two summer festivals.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Downed trees are the trademark of a hurricane's aftermath. We tend to classify them as debris, but in the case of Florida's orange-growing community, those trees are nothing short of tragedy. The devastation of Hurricane Charley is rivaling that of Hurricane Andrew in 1990, and among the hardest hit were Florida's citrus growers. Joining us on the line from Wauchula, Florida, is Pat Carlton, an orange grower. Hello, Pat.
Good day.
Pat, tell us how your groves were affected.
Well, in Wauchula, it's pretty devastating. We've got probably 30, maybe 40% of our trees are either flipped over, twisted, blown up, pretty well decimated. That's just our trees. Our fruit crop, I'm guessing, is anywhere from 60, 70, 80% in Wauchula is basically laid on the ground. And probably after a couple of weeks, I would say probably most of the rest of it may be there.
Wow. Tell us a little bit about the process from here. I guess first you have to clear the fields and then you have to replant?
Yeah, we have to wait on the insurance adjusters to come in and actually start to doing a little bit of an analysis on the status of the grove. And once that happens, we'll go in and we'll start clearing out the dead trees and the uprooted trees, and we'll start a burning process. Right now you can't get a burning permit in our county because there's no electricity, so a lot of people without air condition, and there's a lot of people who have, lung problems.
So you grow the oranges, but then as I think about it, you have to get these trees from somewhere. Where do you get orange trees?
Well, the trees are grown in nurseries in Central Florida. There's a whole nursery industry in Central Florida that we actually, we'll purchase the trees when they're little seedlings, and we'll grow them, and it takes about 6 or 7 years to get a commercially viable crop after you plant them.
And that's where you are right now. In other words, you won't be up and running for another 6 years or so?
If you start with a barren piece of land and you put it in orange grove, it takes you 6, 7 years to get a commercially viable crop produced in order to be able to harvest it with any kind of hope of making a profit.
What are you going to do in the meantime?
Well, in the meantime, it's like we always have done. The trees that aren't uprooted and destroyed, we'll trim some of them back, and we'll start doing some resets and replanting. And you kind of have to wait. This is a rather disastrous event for our area, but it's not unheard of for these things to happen. And in dealing with agriculture, we have natural disasters all the time. In the citrus industry down here, we have freezes that we're susceptible to that do this kind of damage, not necessarily to this extent, but we have droughts and floods all the time, and it's just part of being in agriculture.
Were the nurseries affected?
The nurseries were affected. The foliage nursery people, basically, as a lot of the ones that were affected in our area, their whole operations are gone. The nurseries in our area that actually grow our trees, the smaller trees are spared because there's not as much canopy for the wind to rip.
So you feel like you can replace most of the trees you've lost?
Yeah, we'll be able to replace them over time. There's a bigger factor in this, though. The citrus industry has been decimated with low prices for several years, and there's a lot of people in this industry that have been just barely hanging on for a couple of years. And an event like this is kind of like the knockout blow for a lot of them. It'll take them out of the business completely, especially some of the smaller growers like they are in our area. We've got a shift in demand that's tailed off due to things like the Atkins diet, believe it or not. We're seeing that orange juice is for some reason, is bad for you, and we've been fighting those kind of things for years. We really believe that we started to see some light at the end of the tunnel, and then now, boom, this is taking us another couple of steps back.
All right. Well, Pat, good luck. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Pat Carlton is an orange grower in Wauchula, Florida.
Stay with us.
I'm Frank Stacio.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
So many choices, so little time, and so much summer theater. Well, given all the competition, Ontario, Canada is spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to promote its annual Stratford and Shaw festivals this year, hoping to attract more locals and Americans to bask in a bit of the Bard and other great playwrights. Here and Now's Bill Marks recently traveled to our neighbor up north, and he joins me now in the studio to talk about the state of two stages, the Stratford and Shaw Festival. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Gail.
So I understand audiences are down at both of these festivals, and the Canadian government is doing what it can about it. So when you went up there, what did they say to you?
Well, I spoke to Jackie Maxwell, who's the artistic director of the Shaw Festival, about this very issue, and she told me that that they were scrambling this year.
They're certainly not buying in the same way that they did. And I think that there's a lot more just sort of spur of the moment visiting. But it is down for sure. It's not back to where it was. It's better than it was last year, but it's not back to where it was.
And Bill, do we know why attendance is down?
Well, there's a lot of scuttlebutt up north in terms of why is tourism down, particularly from Americans. The Shaw Festival depends for about 44% of its box office from Americans coming up. SARS scare a year ago, 9/11 still dampening spirits, an economic situation in America that maybe seems to be sometimes up, sometimes down, which is discouraging people from traveling. And perhaps just a general feeling of cocooning. The sense is after 9/11, people sort of want to stay closer to home and don't want to go up. There's also an enormous amount of competition now. Besides Stratford and Shaw, obviously up north in Canada, there are a lot of American festivals now, so people can see theater closer to home.
Is this just a problem for Canada, or is this something that's happening around the world? I mean, for example, the Edinburgh Festival, how's that doing in Scotland?
Well, I mean, I don't have my fingers on all the statistics and box offices. I would say that something like Edinburgh, which is a worldwide event now, it does not seem to be suffering from the same problem. And that is, again, going back to an economy that seems to be a bit shaky, gas prices that are up now, so people aren't necessarily getting into their cars, and just a lot more competition.
Well, specifically as to the Stratford and Shaw festivals, if you've never been, what have you missed?
Well, what are you missing is a lot, really. I mean, I enjoy going up there. I try to go up every year. First off, some of the best Canadian actors are going to be found either at the Shaw or at Stratford. And both of them, more and more, because of the economies, tending to do some of the usual sort of war horses. But they also, in their nooks and crannies, have some really interesting shows to see. For example, Stratford is known for doing Shakespeare. This year, they're doing very strange Shakespeare, Shakespeare you ordinarily wouldn't see, Cymbeline, Timon of Athens, and a Shakespeare play I've never seen, Henry VIII, which I missed, damn it, when I went up there because it wasn't running. These are Shakespeare plays that are so rarely done, and to see them done so well and professionally is a pleasure. And at the Shaw, of course, you have a real dedication to doing neglected masterpieces from the period in which Shaw was alive. So you often see plays from the 1890s, turn of the century, that are well worth seeing, that are never done, and only the Shaw will do them.
Well, speaking of war horses, let's go back for a moment to Macbeth,
yes,
which I understand you got to see. Tell us about that performance.
Well, I did see the Scottish play up there, and there is a bit of a curse accruing. That's why I'm not saying the name.
Yes, I noticed.
I'm saying the Scottish play. And this was this particular production is an interesting one in the sense that it tried a lot of unusual ideas. So there was a lot of Scottish ballads played throughout. And I've never seen the ghosts of Lady Macduff and her children show up at the end, sort of coming out of the ether to Macduff and saying, well, you killed Macbeth, but we're still dead. I would say that it was a production that was a bit uneven, with a Macbeth who was somewhat dwarfed by a very histrionic Lady Macbeth, as you can hear in this clip.
Thy letters have transported me beyond this ignorant present, and I feel now the future in the instant.
My dearest love, Duncan comes here tonight.
And when goes hence?
Tomorrow, as he purposes.
Oh, never shall sun that morrow see.
And again, that's a clip from Macbeth on stage at the Stratford Festival in Ontario, Canada. And then there's the Shaw Festival. they have a very different approach to theater.
They do. I mean, at Stratford, they tend to emphasize Shakespeare and then surrounding Shakespeare with what they call family drama, family events, something like The Count of Monte Cristo and also Guys and Dolls. Shaw does, their bread and butter is George Bernard Shaw. And around Shaw, they often, as I said, do sort of neglected plays from the same period. And they also do the classics, meaning they're doing The Importance of Being Earnest, which is one of the plays that I saw when I was there.
Lady Bracknell, I hate to seem inquisitive, but would you kindly inform me who I am?
I'm afraid the news I have to give you will not altogether please you. You are the son of my poor sister, Mrs. Moncrief, and consequently Algernon's elder brother.
Algy's elder brother?
It's so much fun just hearing the accents.
It's a wonderful play, and it's done in a very sort of a chamber theater style there. And I thought it was pretty shipshape in terms of the production. It didn't emphasize the sort of political subversiveness of the play, which a lot of productions do now. But it was certainly a lot of fun. I would say that both of the productions we talked about, the Macbeth and The Importance of Being Earnest, were done on the sort of main stages. But in both festivals, it was actually things that were done at some of the smaller stages that I found more impressive. At Stratford, they did a production of The Human Voice, which is Jean Cocteau's marvelous monologue about a woman who's being jilted. And at the Shaw, I also had a chance to see a really wonderful play called Rutherford and Son.
Tell me about that one.
That was a play done in 1912 by a young woman. It's set in the North Country of England. It's a marvelous dissection of the patriarchy, of class warfare, of gender roles. And it was a hit in 1912 and then just sort of faded from view. And it was done in 1994 in England, where it did very well. And now the Shaw's doing it in a really marvelous production. I mean, this is the kind of thing that really excites me about the Shaw Festival. They'll do a play that I've never heard of, and it'll turn out to be, if not a masterpiece, a really terrific play. And that's one thing that summer theater can do. It can do new plays. It can do Shakespeare, the classics. And it can also take plays that you've never heard of and do them and say, oh, my God, I'm so glad that I saw it.
Well, so clearly a lot of good theater awaits in Canada. And how long are these festivals going to run?
Summer festivals are beginning to, I think they're going on longer and longer. Both the Shaw and Stratford are now going through November, so well into the fall. And that seems to be a trend, partly due to, I think, for economic reasons, where I think summer theater companies are figuring that if we can get people going early in the summer, maybe we can catch them a little later, and maybe even in the fall.
Go see summer theater, but bring your ski parka.
Bring your parka and bring your heavy coats.
All right. Well, thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Gail.
Here and now is theater critic Bill Marks. For more information on the Stratford and Shaw festivals, check out our website at here-now.org.
And finally, offering the theory that it's no fun to protest on an empty stomach, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg announced a plan to reward peaceful protesters at the upcoming Republican convention. Here's the deal. Demonstrators who mind their manners will get a button featuring a cheerful Lady Liberty holding a sign that identifies the wearer as a peaceful political activist. So after a courteous demonstration of rage against the machine, the famished dissident can duck into the nearest Applebee's and flash the button for a discount on buffalo chicken salad, or even, really, $5 off admission to the Museum of Sex. The vetting process, a little sketchy. Authorized protest groups will actually get the buttons. They can distribute them to their members, so it's not clear if the participating merchants will know if you've been overturning cars before you come to claim your discount. Anyway, a number of protesters expressed skepticism about the program. They dismiss it as a publicity stunt, but at least one voiced approval. Aaron Kay, who is known locally as the Mad Yippie Pie Thrower, noted that delegates to the convention will be getting discounts, so it's only fair that protesters should get equal treatment.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medzen, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Mike Toda. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our intern enjoying his last day with us, thanks, Nick, is Nick Weiss-Richmond.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Frank Stasio.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org. Or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.